Since the 1st of April, TNI, in collaboration with allies, has brought together experts and activists to discuss how the COVID-19 pandemic health crisis exposes the injustices of the global economic order and how it must be a turning point towards creating the systems, structures, and policies that can always protect those who are marginalized and allow everyone to live with dignity. The following is a recording of a webinar that focused on how to build an internationalist response in light of the coming global recession. The panelists explored the likely global impacts of the economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, what a people's agenda would look like, and how we might be better prepared than the 2008 economic crisis to put forward progressive solutions that address the immediate crisis, as well as existing crises of poverty, inequality, and environmental destruction.
Hello and welcome, everyone. We just want to confirm if everyone can hear me. Please type yes in the chat. Welcome to our webinar on the coming global recession, on building an international response to the global coming global recession. My name is Sean Macheza. I'm with the Transnational Institute. This is an event organized by TNI, the Transnational Institute, together with the Alternative Information and Development Center in South Africa, and focus on the Global South. This is the second in a series of webinars that we'll be holding throughout April. The first one was last week on an internationalist response to COVID-19. It's available on YouTube if you'd like to see what transpired then. Please go and look it up on TNI's YouTube. For today, the focus is on some key questions that we want to address. Will be on what will be the economic impact of COVID-19 globally. How is COVID-19 going to impact particularly the Global South? And what should be our priority demands as international activists and movements in terms of the economic response to COVID-19. So in the wake of this virus, how can we advance a progressive and transformative economic response that learns from our failures in 2008? And how can we tackle both this pandemic as it unfolds as a health problem, as well as the underlying structures of injustice that have actually exacerbated the problem? Together with me is are my colleagues from TNI, Jess Graham, who has been organizing this in the background. If you have any questions, any issues you want to ask about, also for follow-up, please go to j.graham@tni.org. She will share the email address on our chat.
I promise I'll be nice.
If you have questions to the panelists, please type them in the Q&A session. In the Q&A section of the Zoom, they will be channeled to the panelists to whom you ask the questions. If you have any other chats or suggestions that you'd like to add, links perhaps to pertinent issues that are being discussed, please share them on the chat, which will itself be made available in a perhaps a slightly more cleaned up version after the webinar is done.
Feel free to email me if you want that.
You can also email j.graham@tni.org for that. The structure of our webinar will be very simple. We will have one key speaker who will make a longer presentation, and our other speakers will respond initially to that presentation and then make their own contributions afterwards. So, in case there are no questions, in case there's everything in order, I would like to get right into it. I'm honored right now to introduce to you Jayati Ghosh, who is an internationally renowned economist and professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University. She's won many awards for her work, including the ILO Decent Work Research Prize and the UNDP Award for Excellence in Analysis. She's the author of India. India and the International Economy. Apologies. published in 2015 and co-edited the Handbook of Alternative Theories of Economic Development in 2018. She's keenly listened to by millions of people worldwide for her analysis on global economy as it impacts on the most marginalized, particularly in the global south. So we're really lucky to have her here to give the key presentation for our webinar. Welcome, Jayati, and thank you for joining us. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Sean. It's a great pleasure to be here, well, sort of, with all of you in this format. I want to go straight into it, and I just want to remind everybody that what we're going through is actually unprecedented. Of course, there are many things we don't know. There are many uncertainties about the severity, the spread, the extent, the timing of this disease. But even before that, we already know that the economic impact is going to be devastating. Indeed, it already is devastating, simply because of the nature of the public response. The lockdowns that we have seen, again, are unprecedented. This has never happened in the global economy, that we have simultaneously shut down large parts of the world economy at once. And this has huge implications. We are not just shutting down demand. We're not just throwing people out of livelihoods, forcing them not to work, not to get their wages. In most parts of the developing world, they're simply not getting wages or incomes over this period, not to be able to sell their products. We're closing down all of that side and therefore reducing incomes. But at the same time, we are reducing supply. We're breaking supply chains. We're making it harder to distribute. We're going to face quite soon in many countries shortages of necessities, not just food and essential drugs, but a whole range of others. So this is genuinely unprecedented. There is no comparison to anything that has ever happened globally in history, in the history of global capitalism for sure. Now, in that, in fact, it's another, the other aspect which is already becoming clear is that this is dramatically increasing inequalities. Existing inequalities, which were already at their peak, we thought, just before the crisis, are now being hugely exacerbated. Cross-country inequality, global power is asserting itself in the most unpleasant ways, and we're seeing that, and within country inequalities, because as usual, the most marginal, the least protected workers are the ones who are directly affected, and those who have salaries, et cetera, who live on rentier income are still managing reasonably well, with given the lockdowns. So in this unprecedented situation, the developing countries are the worst hit. And this has happened through a variety of ways. It's happened, of course, through global trade. Exports have collapsed. They don't exist. When countries themselves are in lockdown, the range of exports you can produce and the volume obviously has collapsed. But exports of services are hugely affected. Travel, transport, everybody's aware of that. Tourism, all of those have gone completely. They've just stopped. But a range of other things. In other words, we now have a cessation of economic activity globally, which has meant that the balance of payments of developing countries has gone for a complete toss. And the chances of that reviving very soon are very low. Because from this, we're going to have negative multiplier effects. In other words, the loss of income, the loss of demand is going to persist because it will feed into further loss of income as we grow over time. And so this is going to get worse and worse in the near future. In addition to that, we have massive bad news on the capital account, which is to say we've already had flight of capital from all the emerging markets. It's typical, even though the United States is currently the worst hit country with the largest number of cases, capital moves to the United States, the flight to safety. And so all of us have experienced huge outflows of portfolio capital, which have affected our stock markets, which have affected financial conditions within the country. External debt is becoming a massive problem. We were actually at a peak already in terms of debt to GDP ratios globally in the US, but also among developing countries. Asia, Latin America, Africa, we had really expanded our borrowing. And a lot of that borrowing was very volatile. It was not just public borrowing from the multilateral institutions. A lot of it was, in fact, short-term commercial borrowing and borrowing in the bond markets. Now, these are notoriously volatile, and of course, they have been volatile. And so we are finding that, first of all, the bond markets have collapsed in most emerging markets. And secondly, that it's harder and harder to service the external debt that we do have, simply because our currencies have depreciated so rapidly in the last 1 week or so. in the last 2 weeks, really. So all of this basically means that developing countries are given a double whammy. And then, of course, our policies of lockdown are hugely creating inequalities within our countries. I mean, India is a classic example. We've had the most draconian, I would say even cruel, lockdown. 90% of our workers are informal. They have basically been thrown out without any recourse because there's almost no social protection. Many of them do not have food for not the next week, even 40%, a recent survey has found, for the next day. And there's very little public response in terms of making sure that there's enough food and making sure that they have enough incomes to survive even during the period of the lockdown. So within countries, there are these huge issues as well. So we are seeing, and I mean, I don't want to depress you all, but this is going to have an impact that are nothing like anything we have seen. Not the great financial crisis, not the Great Depression, not even the two world wars. We are already going to be in an economic situation that is probably worse than all of these in terms of the massive global destruction of livelihoods and breaking of supply chains. So what do we do? Now, if it is such a globally unprecedented challenge, we have to have a global and unprecedented response. And I think that's very important for us to recognize. We can't think small, we can't tinker. We have to have big, big gestures, but we also have to have them quickly. Now, that's a contradiction because we know that, first of all, we have still a global economy that is controlled by neoliberal finance and where the global institutions have shown very little capacity for that kind of vision. We also have the leader of the so-called world, Mr. Trump, engaging in the most nationalistic kinds of responses. And so the chances of global cooperation also look very, very limited. But on the other hand, we're also seeing a recognition that yes, public health spending is important, that maybe it was a mistake to privatize and to reduce government spending on essential health, and that maybe, in fact, if you do not look after the health of the poorest person, you yourself can be in danger among the elites. And that recognition may well lead to an increase in more government health spending. But on the other hand, we need much more, especially if we're going to save the whole of the developing world from this huge economic calamity that is likely to befall us. So we need to make some demands of the global community immediately. And this, many of these are for me second best solutions because some of them necessarily involve the role of the IMF. This is not an institution I have much respect for. This is not an institution that has proved its worth over its history at any point. Nonetheless, we cannot sit around and try and create another institution right now. The IMF has the mandate to create global liquidity. Right now, we need a massive increase in global liquidity available to every country. So we need at least 1 trillion, maybe 1.5 trillion increase in SDRs. Special drawing rights are assets that the IMF creates. It has the power to create them. Every country gets them according to its share of the IMF quota. There are no conditionalities attached when you simply issue new SDRs. And so the IMF cannot say, well, I'll only give you this much if you behave and you do the following conditions. It has to give every country according to its share of quota. Most rich countries don't need it, but for developing countries, it can be a lifeline. So that's one very important immediate measure. We also need immediately a debt moratorium. Most of the debts of the developing world are currently unpayable. They're not going to get paid. So we need to have 3 month, 6 month, moratorium on maybe 6 month moratorium immediately on all debt payments without interest payments being added. And that in turn means that after that, we will then think about debt relief, about actually restructuring all the debt packages, which has to happen because those debts will still be unpayable 6 months down the road. So we have to restructure all of those eventually. And that debt relief has to be a very important part of our demand as well. Developing countries have to institute capital controls. Our currencies have depreciated by 10 to 20%, maybe 30% in some cases, in the last 1 month. We have to stop this bleeding. We have to ensure that capital cannot just move in and out whimsically. So all developing countries have to be allowed to institute capital controls as quickly as possible and in a coordinated way so that they are not singled out by other countries and by mobile finance. Now, one of the things this crisis is going to force governments to do is to reconsider the role of planning, because it is simultaneously a demand crisis and a supply crisis. Because we have stopped production, we have broken supply chains. If we even want to bring back the production and distribution of essentials, we will have to do some planning. Because even food and medicines, if you say, as the basic essentials, they have input and output relationships. You have to make sure they've got all the linkages. For that, you cannot do this without planning, without coordination. And states that had forgotten all about it have to bring it back. So planning is essential. The localization of production is going to become another big thing, because this has shown not just the perils, but the stupidities of globalization. The idea that you can produce fish in the North Sea, which is then processed in Southeast Asia and sent back for consumption in Europe. That kind of nonsense has to end. And so more emphasis on local production, local consumption in a sustainable, viable way for a whole range of commodities. And as I mentioned, the recognition of public goods like health, which had completely gone from our discourse. This is absolutely essential. Massive spending on public health and dignity to health workers, protection and dignity to health workers. These all have to be part of our policy agenda. Now, these are big asks, but they're not entirely ridiculous asks, because people are learning. Things have changed, and the world that we will wake up to when this crisis is finally dealt with will inevitably be a different world. We have to make sure that it doesn't stay the same in terms of the power imbalances that have generated this crisis in the first place. I think I'll stop here and we can get responses, which I'm waiting to hear.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jayati. For those who are just joining us, this was Jayati Ghosh. You have her on your screen over there. We have three other speakers who are going to give their inputs now. Also, for those who just joined, if you are on the chat, you will find contributions by Nick Buxton, my colleague at TNI, and he is giving some context to who's speaking and some pertinent material that may help in their presentations. So thank you for that. If you have questions, put them in the Q&A where my colleague Hamza is going to collate the questions for distribution to the panelists. So thank you very much again, Jayati. I'm now going to ask the fellow panelists to respond to briefly to what you just said. And of course, we want to hear from you, what is the most pressing issue related to the economic fallout from your context, from where you are standing? What do you think we need to be prepared for, and what should we be paying attention to? So up next, we've got Walden Bellow. So these are our upcoming speakers, if you look on your screen. And coming up next is Walden Bellow, who is an associate of TNI and the author of more than 16 books. He was awarded the Right Livelihood Award, known to many as the Alternative Nobel Prize, in 2003. And he's been described by The Economist as the man who popularized a new term, deglobalization. Right? Deglobalization. And by the Canadian author Naomi Klein, as the world's leading no-nonsense revolutionary. His most recent book, co-published by TNI, is Paper Dragons, and it focuses on China and the next economic crash. So, Walden, I'll hand it over to you.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me? Okay. Well, thanks, Jayati. That was such a comprehensive presentation, both of the problem as well as the solutions. And nobody could have done that better than Jayati Ghosh. Okay. Since I am sort of reacting to this, I just wanted to make a few points. First of all, you know, this is the second big crisis of globalization in just over a decade. We had the 2008 financial crisis that many countries never really got out of it, you know. And suddenly this crisis hits, and unfortunately we didn't learn our lessons from that. Once the peak of the financial crisis and the impact on the real economy seems to have gone, then there was just a return to the old order. And, you know, this speeding up of globalized processes, the concentration of production facilities in China, the air connectivity faster and faster, those just picked up. And it seemed like, that the crisis had not happened. And then, boom, this thing happens. And if we had only learned from the very beginning that we had to change the way that we organize economic life as well as our relationship to the planet, we would have avoided a lot of the big problems that have issued right now. The second thing is, I fully agree with Jayati that this is unprecedented. I find it very interesting and crazy that economists in the North are still disagreeing whether this will be a recession or a depression, okay? And if the global economy will shrink by 1.5% or 2%, you know, this is, you know, arranging the deck chairs while the Titanic is sinking. I mean, we are really talking about, you know, 20-25% drop in global GDP. I mean, and you know, it seems like there's a lot of wishful thinking that's going on, maybe to try to convince the powers that be that there will be a return to normality. So it's more wishful thinking rather than a reality that is there. The third thing that I would just like to say is, you know, when the food crisis hits because of the disruption of the agricultural supply chains that have been created also by these transnational corporations, and the food problems begin to really hit and create starvation, etc. This is going to be a second or the third phase of this crisis that will really deepen at this point in time. So, of course, the FAO, says that, oh, there are enough supplies and that sort of thing, but I don't believe that, okay? I mean, you know, there's just this tendency of this transnational multilateral organizations to underemphasize the real problems that are taking place at this point in time. And the one thing that I would just like to add what's going to happen politically. I think there's a tendency of many to see that, oh, it seems like something is being managed. First of all, it's there, public health, and then, you know, there's a lockdown, and then you've got to have stimulus, give it to the people, get some things to tide them over. Well, it's not going to happen that way. The thing is that we are on the midst of a political crisis that will have an impact on how we deal with it economically. Like, people are not going to take sitting down indefinite lockdowns without access to food. I mean, we are facing the possibilities of people really defying the authorities and saying, screw your lockdown, we need to eat. And that is going to happen everywhere. And that I think the authoritarian regimes are particularly scared of this because they know that they won't be able to deal with it. Okay, now that creates both problems as well as opportunities for progressive movements is, let's just say that that's going to happen. There will be a lot of crisis and conflicts on the streets. And how do we make sure that gets channeled in a progressive direction rather than in an authoritarian kind of direction, which is it would be very, very scary. So I just wanted to say that what we need at this point in time, and I agree with Jayati, is really a more activist, interventionist, progressive intervention on the part of states in terms of many of the things that she had said, macroeconomic measures. The one thing that I would just like to add here is that we have to get civil society involved, because so far it's been the state that has been telling people what to do, okay? And people don't want that anymore. They want to have civil society involved to be part of crafting the problem. And if civil society does not get involved in this process, it's not going to work. So those are my 5 minutes worth of response to Jayati Ghosh's excellent presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your contribution, Walden. We hope to have you back sooner rather than later. For those who are just joining us again, please follow the chat session. My colleague Nick Buxton is giving a bit of context and perhaps some additional resources that can help with comprehending the webinar as it unfolds. We've got a few more speakers lined up, and coming up next is Quinn Slobodian. And Quinn is a historian at Wellesley College in Massachusetts in the United States. And he looks at modern German and international history with a focus on North-South politics, social movements, and the intellectual history of neoliberalism. His most recent acclaimed book is Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism, published in 2018. And is currently working on a book on the far right's capitalism. Quinn, from where you stand, how do we go about this?
Thanks so much. I really appreciate what Jayati and Walden had to say, as well as, of course, everyone at TNI for making this happen. I guess I wanted to sort of respond to and then restate or reframe in my own words some of the things that have already been said. And I think one helpful way of looking at the situation is to think about three ways of looking at the virus, right? I think first we can see the virus as a kind of X-ray, right? It's sort of exposed existing structures of societies and economies. So we begin to see how close to the line, for example, people in the United States are living when from one paycheck to the next, suddenly people have to line up in enormous lines simply to get food to put dinner on the table for their families, right? As opposed to other countries where there is more of a safety net or kind of a cushion in savings. The sort of the credit-driven nature of American economics in particular has been laid bare here. So we can see through the response to the virus, the kind of material conditions that we're dealing with here. I think the virus is also acted as a kind of a dress rehearsal, right? It shows us how we will respond to collective challenges. It shows us where trust in institutions is strong, where it's weak, where state capacity exists, where it needs to be charted, sort of invented overnight in a kind of triage approach to an approaching catastrophe. But then the virus is also, I think, of most concern for us as a kind of a dynamo or an engine, right? I mean, I think the natural tendency of the response to the virus will be to exacerbate and exaggerate already existing tendencies in politics, meaning that the virus won't do the work for us as progressives, as I think some people have hoped, that the virus is this sort of external agent which has somehow stepped in, is now paradoxically saved us because it showed the bankruptcy and uselessness of our existing arrangements. It's not going to be that easy. The response, the effect of it will be to actually continue the status quo, unless we take that energy produced by the response to the virus and redirect it, right? So the question is, what kind of measures are necessary to take the kind of window of opportunity that has been produced with its inherent kind of momentum and turn it in a direction other than the one that it will go if left unattended? And I think we know what will happen if it's left unattended, because as the framing of this session suggests, 2008 was already a kind of dress rehearsal for a global recession, right? So I think the question for progressives, and what I wanted to just sort of run down briefly, reiterating some of also what Jayati laid out, is, you know, what are some of the short, medium, and long-term ways that we can make sure that the response to this crisis in 2020 is better than the response to the crisis in 2008. And I think that the short-term question has to be around the nature of the bailouts and this so-called stimulus packages that are already making their way through American government, right? What happened in 2008 was an extremely generous sweetheart deal was effectively given to the financial class in the United States. And there was absolutely no circumstances or consequences for the actions of the financial sector in the United States for having effectively produced the very crisis that we were all suffering through. The bonuses, the dividends, the incentive structure was all left basically untouched, right? And we saw that it was left untouched because what proceeded from 2008 was simply a ramping back up of the same kind of casino capitalism that had led to 2008 in the first place. So short term, immediately, there needs to be conditions in the bailouts. There needs to be some of the things that we've already seen, which is a prohibition on bonuses, on share buybacks, on dividends in the short run, oversight for those resources and assets that the government has now effectively become the owner of. And then I think we need to think more broadly, right? I think that questions of getting worker representation on boards should be part of a kind of bailout structure. The international questions that are exposed that are important in the short term are, as Jayati said, the need for immediate debt moratoria of the kind that Argentina has just done, right? I mean, just pausing debt repayments for at least a year. And the Fed's response, the Federal Reserve of the United States needs to open up swap lines to all member countries, right? Not just to the select ones. And then also to obviously expand the SDRs through the IMF, the way that Jayati said as well. So I think that there's those things, some of which chances maybe have already been passed, right? It's this last week, Donald Trump just fired the very person who was to be in charge of the dispersal of the funds through this $2 trillion stimulus. So this horse has maybe already left the stable. We can only ever do so much, but I think that the first lesson there of 2008 was don't let the kind of immediate crisis management be a kind of a black box where, you know, former employees of Goldman Sachs can transfer public funds to current employees of Goldman Sachs, because that's effectively what happened in 2008. It was a triage move, but it was one that ended up leaving the chief protagonist kind of untouched. So I think that's an issue, obviously, in the short term, but for us, probably where we're going to be able to be more effective is in more of that medium-term redirection of the kind of the dynamo of the state response to the virus. And the immediate turn that everyone has made is exactly what I think Walden said, which is to the state, right? There's, I think that the most common sense read of what's happening right now is that the state is back. State capacity, where it was large, has proven to be effective. Where it was minimal, as in places like the United States, will need to be restored. And that then the politics of the next year or two or whatever going forward will be, how can you seize that central state capacity and aim it in the progressive rather than regressive directions? But I actually think that might be a misapprehension of the situation, or at least a misapprehension of the opportunities produced by this moment. I think if anything about the Corbyn and the Sanders campaign has taught us is that there isn't a mechanical relationship between a material situation, i.e. bad social safety net and inequality, and people's preference for a national leader who will remedy those very problems, right? I mean, it seems that as much as we talk about inequality, inequality doesn't naturally lead to a political response to remedy it. So the state level, the national state level, might actually be the wrong place to focus right now. I think that, and also Walden also gestured to this too, I think the local has become much more pertinent in the course of this crisis than maybe we thought before, right? Meaning local food security, right? exactly as Jayati said, why do we need to depend on such extended global supply chains just to feed ourselves? Meaning local forms of preparedness. So I was thinking that, you know, in the United States, we have active shooter drills in elementary schools. Why aren't those replaced with pandemic preparedness, whole of country rehearsals of the kind that they had in Taiwan after SARS that helped them precisely be ready for the next pandemic? I think those kinds of forms of emergency preparedness don't have to be paranoia inducing. They can also be solidarity creating, where they can also make people feel like they have a collective stake in each other's well-being. And versions of that are already popping up, right? Sort of middle-class streets have afternoon gatherings where everybody comes out of their houses and checks in on each other, just verbally, in a way that had never been happening before. So I think that those attention to like local neighborhood level infrastructures of care and provisioning are things that we as progressives should build on, right? I think we should look at those as sort of very fertile sites of new forms of political action and those forms of social reproduction that we rely on so much in at least the advanced, you know, richer countries, the daycare centers, the kindergarten teachers, are all now, you know, seen as being absolutely mandatory aspects of the kind of components of the social contract. So I think that using those places as sites of labor organizing and kind of inventiveness for resilience in the present and in the addressing of future crises is something that we should do to look away from just that four-year election cycle or the kind of the process of congressional politics. We should actually be concentrating on local transformative processes as well. The last thing I wanted to say is about the international response. If one scale to look at is down, the other one is up, right? I mean, I think the natural response to the American attack on the WTO, for example, is to say that, well, that form of political organization is at least one we don't have to worry about anymore because it's been effectively crippled by, you know, the most powerful actor in the world, the United States. But there's another way of looking at it, which is it has left the field open for rethinking and reimagining and retooling of what those institutions are. So Jayati said that, you know, the IMF has never been really an institution that we'd want to put much stock in. And I would agree more or less, but one thing you see in the history of the IMF is how much its own mandate has changed, right? I mean, it was created to allow for expansionary policy. Didn't always work that way. And then it only changed over time to become the global policeman for American financial capitalism. So one sort of positive way of spinning the situation is whether or not we can take the kind of master's tools of the international institutions and in this moment where they're being basically abandoned by the most powerful actor in the world, the United States, remake them in kind of our own image or for our own purposes. But the question there that I wanted to actually leave to some of the panelists too is how much effective internationalism of that kind is possible without any kind of American buy-in or leadership? I mean, how far can we get if the motor of the world economy is not going to play along? Can China play that role that the United States once did, however imperfectly? So I think I'll leave it with that.
Great. Thank you so much, Quinn. Quinn is speaking to us from the United States, and he's a historian at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. His most recent book was Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism. Please look that up when you have a moment. And just so we keep the time, upcoming speaker is Lebohang Peko, I guess. Lebohang is a public intellectual. She's a writer, a scholar, activist, policy analysis and lecturer. She is the senior research fellow of a think tank called Trade Collective that works on international trade, the political economy, globalization in the context of migration, regional integration, and feminist economics in relation to the global South. Lebohang is joining us from South Africa. Dumela ma, sawubona, and the floor is yours.
Audible.
Now we hear you now.
Thanks. So I want to just pick up exactly where the esteemed co-panelists have left it off. And the one I think is the notion of false sentiment and how we're not here by chance, and we didn't get here over the last few months because of some dodgy virus created somewhere or other. But I mean, this is really, I see this as part of an epoch moment on the ongoing rollout and the ongoing deconstruction of states dating back to the 1970s. I mean, it's the latest wave of structural readjustment, and the emphasis being that states need to retract. And then we've seen that in the healthcare sector, in the economy, and the over-privileging of markets and financialization of our states is exactly what has brought us here. So this isn't really a surprise. As Jayati said, in many respects, we've been here in different ways before. And we've been here, I mean, most recently in 2008, but I think it's been a moment that's been coming. And secondly, I would like to say that in so doing, what does this mean in relation to false sentiment? So I'm really intrigued that in all of this, currencies, the South African rand significantly, the Kenya shilling, we're all depreciating daily against the US dollar, even though their economy is retracting and shrinking at roughly the same pace as ours. I mean, and of course they do weird things in order to, you know, they do print money like it's going out of fashion in order to create false sentiment. And this is a really important way to moment to expose the extent to which, despite all of this, all eyes face to the US in particular, and to a much lesser extent to the European Union. And it's very surprising to me that at a time when we're talking about this being a great equalizer, it actually is not, because particular sentiments and particular economies and currencies still hold a lot of sentiment, which is still wielded in this neoliberal imperial market orthodox assumption that the world is based on a northern paradigm of what the economy should look like. The next lesson from this, and again picking up from the previous speakers, is that debt is bad. It's bad, bad, bad. It's bad morning, noon, and night. And yet the level of credit defaulting and the habitual, you know, lending, hedge funds, the plethora of conversations on sovereign wealth funds, which we've been beset with, particularly in this country over the last few weeks as well. And as though these are instruments that are inherently able to redistribute and reallocate economic benefits, financial benefits, and opportunities to people and most people in the community, in society, has become part of a mantra. Sovereign wealth funds will solve everything, which in fact they won't. And I'll say, you know, why I don't think, I mean, the ones that we've had over the past few couple of decades on this continent, in Nigeria and Chad, have failed spectacularly. And those are cannot be a panacea. Worryingly enough, they're just yet another instrument, oftentimes part of the prescripts of international finance governance and super internationalism that is imposed on African states and countries in the global south. This, of course, as other speakers have said, illustrates the extent to which systemic cleavages and structural cleavages have already been in place. So Corona happened is a terrible thing that happened to the world, but it happened because it could, right? It happened because healthcare is fragile. It happened because economic states have stepped back to such an extent that they barely exist. And I see this as a really important opportunity to claim back states, but also to rethink what states actually are. What exactly do we expect of them? What do we expect from them, especially in a context and in an era where they have oftentimes been little more than the chattel and the lackeys of international finance institutions. And does this time of crisis give us the opportunity to place different demands and to really rethink and reimagine where we want to be? And I say this as well in the context of what regionalism should mean. So states in relation to little places which have flags and borders are clearly not sufficient, as particularly in the African context. This could be a really good opportunity for us to rethink what regionalism means, because I think regionalism also gives us the opportunity to rethink what value chain appreciation could be. And this whole constant looking outward, and when we say we're going global, we always think of going global and doing business as having to be big Europe big America, big Japan to some extent, big Canada to a lesser extent, and of course, biggest China. And all of these things have been shown to be, these places and these spaces have been shown to be fragile, subject to a lot of economic chaos. And I think what happens is that we lose our anchor in the global south when this happens, and yet we use the same instruments to try to reconfigure and to readjust ourselves. And then that said, then what does it mean then in the context of the sort of global greed and the glut that has happened? So a few things have happened. A few countries have decided that it would be a really great idea to overvalue a few currencies. And in so much, and in so overvaluing, especially the dollar US, and you know, people are calling what's happening between the US and China trade war. I don't think it's a war, it's an aggression, it's a hostility, but this is not really, that is not war in the real sense of the term. But I do think that what it does illustrate is that once we have a situation where we have a multipolar sense of what currencies and what economies should look like, and multipolar poles of power, strength, and influence based on commodities, based on common sentiment, based on democratizing what economics should be and how they should be played out, we probably will have a different worldview and the potential to reframe ourselves in different ways. The kind of the glut and I think the concern that we saw, I suppose everybody has seen pictures of people running around helter-skelter, looking kind of crazy, pushing five trolleys of grocery around. This whole need and this instinct to close in on ourselves and to try and consume as much as possible, collect as much as possible in order for this oncoming lockdown or close down or shut down. I find the language of lockdown, by the way, incredibly problematic politically as well. And I think that's an important conversation, because it also speaks to the ways in which states have taken a very militaristic approach, and including militarizing our economies and militarizing the distribution. And this has come into sharp focus at a time such as this, that of course this is all about fear, right? So people running, those who can, running around and trying to consume as much as possible, and those who could not, and people here in this country in particular get paid either on the 25th of the month or on the 30th of the month, just a day after the curfew or the martial law, which it effectively is, was brought into play, were then left out of this loop, presented as these lawless, rebellious, these lawless, rebellious people who could not be trusted, these stupid peasants who cannot be trusted to just follow a few basic instructions. And yet they have been locked out of the system economically, and locked out in ways which are endemic, which are intergenerational, and which again have their origins in a generation and systemic abuse and structural neglect that far predates COVID-19. So food security and value chain addition as part of a very important way of seeing how we can nourish and sustain ourselves, because the biggest fear is, are we going to starve in the midst of all this? Are we going to die and never eat again and never see sunshine again? And what does that actually look like? And lastly, I think that it's also the opportunity for us to rethink the false assumptions about what state banks could, the role that state banks could particularly play, the role that things like basic income grants, and these are debates that are now coming back into fashion. Interesting that, of course, the US, as always, uses a quasi-socialist, quasi-statist approach to bail out their citizens as much as they bailed out Wall Street in 2008, and the state intervened very strongly, although they want the rest of us to step back and renege on our states as though they're just props in some kind of a play. So interesting that they are having this debate and utilizing it in a very real way. I do suggest that the IMF is a horrible institution. I couldn't agree more. And I would like us to think about ways and different mechanisms to think through where we could get different forms of funding. I mean, whether it's reserve banks, we have different state-owned enterprises here and different investment corporations, which most countries do, national investment corporations. By way of other recommendations, this could be a very useful time and space to rethink and make demands again that things that were dismantled, which were perfectly useful. I mean, think people like me and many people on this call who were unfortunate enough to live through every phase of structural adjustment. So structural adjustment growing up in Southern Africa as a child of exile, and then structural adjustment as a child of exile again, living through the Thatcher years in the UK and the US, Reaganomics and Thatcherism. Thatcher milk snatcher, we all remember her. And that, again, I think it wasn't only a metaphor for that particular moment, but in fact, the milk has not only been snatched for good, it has also, you know, the supply was taken. It was then decided who was going to supply at what cost. And I think that this is a really important moment for us to rethink things like agricultural boards, land boards, and so on and so forth, particular grain boards, wheat boards, things which will then minimize this huge distance between us as suppliers and consumers, and the freighting distances, which are quite ridiculous, the disrespect for the planet and the environment, which is involved in transporting these goods miles and miles away, the disgusting dumping, of course, that takes place from the north to the south. I think that at a time when the world is fragile, including, and I think in particular, the global north, because in the south, we're used to precarity, we're used to suffering. Pain is not that difficult for us. It's difficult if you're living in the UK or in Washington and you're like, oh dear, I can't go jogging, I can't walk my dog and bloody blah, blah. Well, look, we're used to suffering. Pain is not that hard, unfortunately. It's part of our DNA of survival, of having survived colonialism and the slave trade and apartheid and all of these things, and structural adjustment and the different forms of trauma. So I think that as global southern entities and development actors, we have a massive and important opportunity right now to frame and reframe demands and to reimagine things that could be different to the global north, renegotiate particular trade agreements right now, because quite frankly, what will they do other than sit hoping for the sunshine one more time and sit imagining what a world without us would be? It would be nothing without the global south.
Thank you so much, Lebohang. That's Lebohang Peko speaking to us from South Africa. We have Walden for just a few more minutes because I know, Walden, you have to be off at 5. So I'm going to bring you back in real quick. So you just wrote a book about financial crisis, past, present, and future ones, your book, Paper Dragons. I was wondering if you could share on the pre-existing vulnerabilities in the global economy right now. What's different between what's happening now and what happened in 2008? What are the challenges and opportunities that present themselves, and how should we act?
Well, I think what happened in 2008, was basically an uncontrolled global financial system. I mean, uncontrolled by citizens and by, governments, and driven mainly by the interests, of the big financial oligopolies and by tremendous speculation, where money had been pushed into financial speculation rather than to the productive system. And this was what imploded during that time. And then as Quinn said, the aftermath of that was basically all throughout the global north is that governments from the United States to the UK to Germany focused their resources on saving the banks, on saving the big financial oligopolies. And instead of nationalizing all of these actors, like, Bank of America, et cetera, in fact, bailed them out and put them as the pure priority rather than saving jobs and saving homeowners. So I think that was the situation then. I think that what is happening now could in fact turn in the same way. And in fact, the debates in the United States between the Republicans and Democrats about where you focus your resources, do you focus them on businesses and corporations and Boeing, et cetera, or do you focus them on giving assistance, to the people who are suffering, that goes beyond just the $1,200 check that they will get, which is really quite, quite small given the crisis. So it could still go, you know, that way. Although I think right now, I think there's more sense, there might be more sensitivity to, you know, the fact that, because of the crisis situation, that people are not going to stand up for something as blatant as saving the rich and saving the banks. But I think we need to be conscious of the class character of these governments at this point in time, that yes, they may retreat here a bit. Yes, they may have some populist measures, but that effectively what these governments are about are really, how do you save the capitalist system at this point in time when it is facing the most severe crisis in its history? So I think we need to keep that political economy class dimension there. You know, that we have to really watch out that even as states begin to act this way and to lose some control, that basically they are instruments of the elite. They're instruments of the ruling class. And, you know, that's why I think the approach to them is to be constantly pressure, and not to let up on the pressure, you know, that it's got to be spending for social purposes for the people at this point in time. And that brings me back to the point which has been raised, which is that these lockdowns, which Le Bohang has rightfully said, you know, are, you know, a terrible word, is in fact lockdowns that are imposed, you know, from above. Now, to some extent, you might have some, you know, need for that in the initial phases for emergencies. But I think the problem that is happening in so many countries, including the Philippines at this point in time, is that these lockdowns, these authoritarian measures are being used by regimes, not just for public emergency, but to strengthen their control over the state. This is what's happening, I think, in India, in the Philippines, and many other places. And Duterte, for instance, has said, hey, he said this, that, hey, if you don't behave, if you go out of your house, I will have the police shoot you. I mean, this is what this guy is saying. So I think that's even more important to bring in, you know, the role of citizens, whether you call it citizens or civil society or the local. We really have to fight to gain control of this process, to have popular input into this process, you know, despite the fact that they're framing it as quote unquote, you know, I mean, it is an emergency, but it should not be an emergency that's used in order to strengthen authoritarian controls, which is a very terrible thing that is happening at this point. And I think that, one of the, and the last point I would just like to say here is what I think Jason has raised. Is there going to be more problems about viruses in the future? And I think one of the things that that we've already seen is this huge mega projects, for instance, the Belt and Road Initiative of China, that is being promoted as the big connectivity to bring all countries together, not only to Europe and Asia, but, you know, Asia to the North Pole and the South Pole. Amazing, you know, push for a big developmentalist kind of, as Arundhati Roy says, gigantistic mentality. And the interesting thing about it, or the scary thing about it, is that it has been estimated that about 800 alien amphibians, species would be introduced by this whole process to habitats where they've not been before. And this is going to create both, you know, viral and general ecological destabilization in a number of places. And many of the wildlife that are being threatened, like civet cats and pangolins, have also been animal hosts of these viruses. The viruses are not harmful to them, but they're also, you know, when their habitat is disrupted by human activity, that creates the condition for animal to species leaping to another species. So, you know, so I think this whole thing is calls into question so many of these old developmentalist mindset projects that are really don't have respect for the planet at this point in time. So I think we're facing not just a social crisis to which we need social and progressive solutions, but really are facing ecological crisis, which we need to make sure that this old developmentalist kind of mentality doesn't create situations like we are in right now. So one last thing, of course, before I leave is, it's very important to have these medium and short-term measures in which institutions are important institutions, despite the fact that they're problematic, are forced to move in a progressive direction. But I think this is also an opportunity, you know, whereby we really need to take advantage of the opportunity for radical restructuring the way that we organize our economic life, the way that, you know, that our economic life relates to the ecology of the planet. So I don't know what you call it. I hate to sound so simplistic, but I think this is really a chance for a different kind of organizing of the way that human beings relate to one another, whether you call that socialism, whether you call that popular democracy, whether you call that substantive democracy. This is a moment that cannot be wasted, okay? Because in 2008, that was precisely what was, that opportunity was not taken up. And I think we can't afford to let this opportunity pass for a more radical restructuring of the system, even as we intervene with the short and medium term measures. So I'm terribly sorry that I have to leave, but I have to meet my class by web, okay? And it was so pleasant and to be with all of you, Jayati, Quinn, Lebong, and of course, all those that had very important questions that they were throwing out. Unfortunately, I do have to go. And thanks a lot to TNI and all the other sponsors.
Thank you very much, Walden. Walden is joining us from Thailand. And thank you for giving us this 1 hour. We know it's very hectic times all around. Up next, I'd like to ask very quickly, Lebohang, what do you consider to be the main international priorities right now when we're addressing the crisis of COVID-19, especially also with the pre-existing crises in South Africa and in Africa? I'm from Zimbabwe. And yeah. I'm scared for what could happen if this was to hit Zimbabwe the way it's hit in the global north. And as you answer that, could you also give us a little glimpse into what you think a feminist response would be like to this crisis?
I think I'll start with the feminist response, actually, because I think we need to think through, and because the feminist response, in my opinion, is what is a salvation for humanity, quite frankly, particularly from the Global South and a Black feminist iteration, an African feminist iteration, which is grounded in exactly this kind of anti-imperial, anti-colonial, including financial imperialism, economic imperialism that we're experiencing. So how do we think about, and rethinking about the foundational values of what we mean by the economy and by markets, by states, and thinking about what personal autonomy means in the when we think about reciprocity. So with reciprocity of benefits, production, goods and services, what that would look like if we were able to frame it in ways that benefit and valorize the producers, which is, you know, usually women in the Global South, Black women, Black and brown women. And also, what would that mean in terms of our political agency? And I think that there's a lot to be said about the ecological and environmental mechanisms which feminist approaches do offer. Because what these suggest as well is that this fixation that market orthodoxy or neoliberalism has on reforms, on competitiveness really needs to be rethunked, absolutely. And this means also the regulation of banks, tech companies, rethinking equality of opportunity, reducing labor market discrimination, and the ways that we redistribute, you know, whether it's wealth taxes or different forms of taxes. This could potentially lead to a far more sustainable solidarity-based system of market economies, where governments, remember them, act on the on behalf of the broader populace and act on behalf of the of people, residents, citizens, and actors, social actors in across countries and within countries, who are then able to then think through the, you know, we should then be able to think through a kind of macroeconomic theory and policy that's constructed within a broader framework of human well-being, rather than just about the numbers, the curves, the graphs of how economies function. I think that another important part of this is that we need to rethink what GDP actually is and whether it's really any use. I've been part of a formation called Wellbeing Economics, and that's also looking at alternatives to GDP. And I'm suspecting that many people who are listening in or tuning into this will be part of those conversations. But GDP is bunk. I mean, that we know. It's an archaic, lousy mechanism, you know, instrument that was again created by your Bretton Woods institutions at the end of the Second World War, and it was all about rebuilding Europe. It was never intended to be a proxy for the progress and the health and the social developmental indicators of any nation's country, of any nation or any country, and now it's become this proxy. Rather than chasing things like employment, things like mortality rates, things like education, things like healthcare, if only we had used healthcare as a measure of nations' health, perhaps the world would not be in this ridiculous dilemma, this unnecessary catastrophe that we're in right now.
Thank you so much, Lebokang. Very quickly, Quinn, I'd like to come to you. You've been researching the far right. You've been studying the far right agenda on neoliberalism. What can we expect from them in this crisis? And how should the left prepare for what the establishment, for what they want to be the establishment?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't mind, just really quickly, I just wanted to echo what Lebohang said there about the kinds of lessons of Black feminism in particular, and feminism, because there's lessons there about survival, as I think Lebohang is saying, and then by which we mean lessons of social reproduction, right? And I think we're looking at what we need at a baseline level to get through from day to day, and that's extraordinarily important. The other aspect of survival that hits us all globally is, of course, the question of climate that I neglected somehow to mention in my opening statement there. What I think that the most important window of opportunity is here that the left needs to watch for, because the right is not going to act on, is the historical drop in the market valuation of carbon companies and the collapse of oil prices has produced, even though this is happening in the shadow of the virus itself, this has produced a moment where oil, petroleum stocks have now become the sort of the mythical stranded asset where people literally don't want to own these things. But the places that are producing oil that requires a lot of resources to extract have seen their oil prices drop into the negative in some cases. In other words, they're actually offering people money to take the oil off their hands. So it's a classic case of this highly leveraged sector of the economy that also can't turn off and on very well, meaning that it's very vulnerable, right? It's a kind of a soft underbelly right now of the carbon economy. And even as we concentrate on the sort of day-to-day survival questions, I think we also need to see how we can lock in ways that when people come back to work, they're coming back to work for a kind of a low carbon future, for a kind of a green infrastructure rather than the same old infrastructure. Right, one that will put the sort of the skills of construction and the trades and all of the things that the services that power the economies of countries like the United States towards a kind of a carbon neutral, zero carbon model rather than the one that we had before. So that's, I would be remiss to mention the question of climate. I think that the difference between 2008 and 2020 also for the left is in 2008, I think a lot of us saw kind of finance and the question of money as a kind of a black box. And we've been concentrating on it ever since, right? I mean, Occupy came out of an obsession with debt, the argument about the debt jubilee and the need for the relief and the forgiveness of debt globally comes out of a kind of a learning process out of 2008. So there's this new consciousness, I think, about the kind of the fungibility of money, right? This idea like we can't pay for that, it's just not very persuasive to anyone anymore. But it's also, it should be hastened to add, not that persuasive for people who are supporting right-wing parties either. So I think right-wing parties, especially you look at the League in Italy or the National Rally in France, have become kind of anti-austerity parties too, right? And so now I think once you see that monetary policy in a world of kind of near zero interest rates and deflation rather than inflation, monetary policy can just turn this sort of fire hose or bazooka of money at things, and you know, you don't seem to get inflation. You seem to be able to produce money perpetually in a place like the European Union and the United States. The right is learning from that too, right? And so that's, I think, our concern, is that the right will say, oh, if debt doesn't matter anymore, and if we can spend all day, then we'll use it to protect our people and sort of hypercharge the exclusionary, you know, border control, punitive measures against immigrants that that are already part of their agenda, and to of course to turn away from all of the aspects of you know, international solidarity and climate attention that is absolutely required. So my suspicion is that we might be thinking a bit too rationally if we think that the outcome of this will just be a simple sequence of states are back. Now, who gets to control the state and how can we prepare for the next crisis better, right? I mean, the last few years of global politics have shown us that the most outrageous, ridiculous forms of political rhetoric are probably the kinds that are going to be present in 6 months. And it's more likely than not that 6 months from now, we're going to be trying to argue against the various far-right policies of political parties about theories of 5G having produced the virus, the Chinese having hatched it in some, you know, Himalayan lab to release on the American or European public. I mean, we are going to be in an era of sort of fantasy and fabulism, most likely, as the right picks up on the ways that a crisis can be resolved and then leveraged for its own use. So part of this effort will be just simple deploying of basic scientific facts. But I think we also learn that facts and plans aren't always the best kind of politics. So we're also going to have to figure out, as a left, ways to kind of message and simplify and pare down what it is we want into a kind of a digestible a way of, you know, thinking about the future that works in, you know, the United States the same way it works in South Africa and Zimbabwe and India, and things like the Green New Deal, right? I mean, and as effective as they've been in places like the United States, I don't think that scans in other parts of the world. So I think it's important also to come up with slogans, as simplistic as that sounds, that we can all kind of rally around. So that's something I'm also looking for in that sort of global response.
Great. Thank you so much, Quinn. And that really ties into a very strong strand of questions that we've been getting from people that are attending the seminar, exactly the webinar. How do we engage a people's agenda and bring in a role of civil society and organize in terms of these lockdowns? Jayati, what political leverage is there for the policies that you so lucidly outlined? How can we be mobilized to influence institutions like the IMF? And how can citizens be really active and brought to be instrumental for their own emancipation, considering the existing power structures and especially with authoritarianism? That sounds a little broad. We put this all together. It's kind of like a strand of question that we got. And I'm curious what your thoughts are. So basically, people are tuned in to find out, what should we do?
Of course, the easiest. Oh, sorry, I have to unmute. One second, let me just...
You're unmuted now.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you. Yeah, well, thanks. That's, of course, a very easy question to answer, Sean. Thank you. But it's great. This is a great discussion. And it's also great to see so many friends here, Alejandro and Oscar and Radhika and others, and amazing questions and discussion here. So I will not be able to do justice to all of it, but I do just want to pick up on a couple of them that were already raised before coming to this very big and broad one. So listen, let's remember this is a big crisis, but the problem with capitalist crises is that they affect workers, peasants, and women most. So this is going to be very, very bad news for all of the people whom we feel that we are in solidarity with, and their bargaining power will be worse, their conditions will be worse. As Walden states, said, states are going to use this opportunity to increase monitoring, surveillance, centralized control. They're already doing it. They have tasted blood and it's going to get worse. So let's not kid ourselves that this is going to be a very bad time. And it's not that because capitalism has exposed itself, and it's, which it did earlier as well, that suddenly everyone's going to say, oh, fine, let's now think of doing something else. It's not going to be that way. Structures of power are still not, in that sense, dramatically affected. And as Quinn said, you know, we are not able to capture the narrative or even to capture the popular imagination in a way sufficiently to actually do the kinds of things we want. That doesn't mean that we have to just all, you know, go home and go to bed and forget about it because it's too desperate to think about. No, it doesn't mean that, because since it is so unprecedented, since this is a global crisis of a magnitude that is beyond description, we are going to get outcomes that we cannot yet anticipate. Now, some of these outcomes can be horrible. I think a number of the questions raise the possibility of war, and I think we have to recognize it's there very much. I mean, a lot, the kinds of leadership we have globally, unfortunately, the possibilities of war in a time like this are quite real. And it could even be at the end of all this, you know, a war over medicine, a war over something else, or just, you know, a way to mobilize your population against some other rather than against yourself. And so all of these are very much on the cards. We can't pretend that these are not possibilities. That's the first point. The second is the whole issue about whether we're all being very reformist rather than, you know, revolutionary or just at least, you know, much more transformative. And yes, there is this problem, but let's think of it this way. I agree completely with Le Bohan that, you know, our response has got to be socialist, feminist, and ecologically conscious, yes? But it also has to be recognizing the realities that we're faced with right now globally and what can be done immediately, because we are talking about immense human suffering that is going to happen. And I repeat, 2008 was a walk in the park compared to what we're going to see after this. And this is independent of whether, you know, medicine is found and a vaccine is found for the virus and it's contained and all that, all of which we don't know. But independent of that, we have already created this huge economic disaster. Gabriella asked a very good question. Why did everybody do this lockdown? Good question. I don't know. I don't want to be conspiracy theory about it, but really, it is an extraordinary response to what was still a relatively small public health emergency. So it's another thing that we, you know, deserves more discussion, but yes, absolutely. Now, in that situation, we have to think long-term, or we have to have the long-term perspective, but we need immediate responses. So the immediate responses definitely have to include some of the things that I had mentioned. Lots of questions on the SDR. I think we need to just clarify, SDRs do not require an increase in the capital base of the IMF. SDRs are global liquidity that can be created, okay? And which do not have to be based on a dollar. They do not. There is no commodity base and there is no currency base to the SDR. It's a unit of account. Every country, every member country simply has them in their in the IMF, and they can exchange them. So yes, if there were well-meaning rich countries, they could donate SDRs to developing countries. It's never happened so far, but who knows? But that's not going to happen. The point is, if you get an allocation of SDRs, the rich countries may not use them. They would just lie there. But at least developing countries have some foreign exchange. because a debt moratorium, which is essential, is still not going to be enough. All your foreign exchange earnings have collapsed. Developing countries have got no foreign exchange access at the moment, and capital is leaving. So you put capital controls to prevent capital leaving, but you still don't have enough foreign exchange. You need something to get the minimum imports for your people. And most developing countries have a lot of necessary imports. So these are all things we need just to prevent greater disaster, greater human catastrophe happening in our countries, I would say. These are not going to transform the system. These are not transformative. For transformative, we have to bring in both the green elements, which is, by which I mean the emphasis of on an ecologically viable method of human existence, which we have lost completely, and I agree with Lebohang completely. GDP is a disastrous indicator, but we need to bring that in, and we need to bring in care and the recognition of care work, paid, unpaid, underpaid, etc., as a critical part of that future. So I would say that our broader response, that what I've outlined was the first immediate, how do we cope with this huge human disaster? And then, of course, there will be national policies of coping and minimizing the damage that is going to happen. But we must, for the future, bring in greater social recognition of the huge human and material significance of care. And maybe this pandemic will do a little bit of that. Because in fact, the combination of the significance of health workers and the lockdown's impact on realizing how much everybody relies on care work in different ways in their lives might have an impact socially. And we need to combine that in our responses and emphasize those issues in terms of whether it's domestic workers, whether it's nurses, whether it's all kinds of, you know, health workers at the front lines, nutrition workers, therapists, etc., bring in the significance of care. There was a question about whether global supply chains are going to be, you know, that the fact that we're saying we have to move away from some of these crazy global supply chains, that will impact on workers in the South. Yes. But listen, workers in the South are going to be horribly impacted every which way you look. Their recovery is not going to happen by pleading to get back into some global supply chain. Their recovery will happen if every country enforces employment policies of its own. It will have to be based on that, which prioritize not just local demand, but regional demand. Regional cooperation is a very important element of this, and care work, which we massively underprovide across the world, which can be a huge means of actually delivering employment and a better quality of life. I'm going on too long, but I will stop soon. There's just another final point I want to make. And that was a very deep and fundamental question, that we've all got horrible leaderships, or maybe not all, but most of us have got really bad leaderships, okay? Certainly in India, I don't even want to begin about talking about it, but in many of our countries, we do not have governments that are going to even negotiate for the kinds of things that we are asking for. Walden was absolutely right. Therefore, civil society has to be involved. On the other hand, we know civil society isn't involved in these negotiations. It doesn't work that way, right? We can say what we like, nobody listens. They go and have their meetings, often in secret, and then they come back with a particular package that all of us have to deal with. In this reality, how do we change it? And how do we create enough public opinion within our countries and globally that, in fact, governments are forced to respond? And I think this is where, you know, what Quinn said is absolutely right, that COVID is not going to do this for us, right? COVID is creating a crisis in which, let's face it, all of the left's constituency is going to be decimated, and therefore left itself is going to be much weaker. How do we revive the left agenda in that situation is essentially by capturing the imagination. And so he said, you know, we need a global, I don't know if we need a global one. Maybe we do need a global one, but I don't think we need a global. We need in every country to actually have a few of these significant one or two things that actually captures people's imagination. And in India, you know, I mean, in India, for example, recently, there's been this huge thing where religious polarization has become the basis, to the point where we have even communalized, polarized COVID. We've started blaming minorities for COVID and so on, okay? So we've had a really bad situation in terms of the state's ability to divert attention to other issues. But But something like this brings you back to the basics, to your access to food, to a livelihood, to a minimal capacity to live in decent conditions. And those will then, I think people will start demanding of their conditions and of the state that they should be allowed to live in those. If we can capture a few demands that make that states will find it impossible not to address, if you see what I mean, in our countries, and then insist on a global context which enables those countries to achieve those demands, I think that would be the way forward.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jayati. We won't have time to go over to our other speakers, but thank you so much for that perspective that kind of zoomed out and brought all these different elements together. And I know we've got a lot of questions that have come from our attendees on the chat, and we only scratch the surface with these webinars. We know it leaves a lot of material out. We can't answer all the different dimensions of what's an extremely complex situation that we're in. But we're keen to deepen the conversation. So next week, we have another webinar. So we're going to have a webinar every week. And next week at the same time, we'll be looking at the agro industry, the role of agro industry in causing this pandemic, and how we might use this moment to advance agroecological forms of farming. So if you're interested in that, and I saw some questions in the chat about that particular topic, we'll go deep into that next week. The week after, we'll be joined by, on the 22nd rather, we'll have a webinar on big pharma and on challenging the corporations benefiting from this crisis. And I did see a few questions that linked to that, the role of pharmaceutical companies. And on the 29th, we'll examine how to challenge the authoritarian dimensions of the response to this crisis. For those of us who also understand Spanish, we'll be running a parallel series in Spanish that you can find out about on TNI's website. Thank you once again to all our speakers. I'll mention that this webinar was hosted by TNI, co-hosted in partnership with AIDC South Africa and Focus on the Global South. We are only trying to bring people together to build solidarity, to create the conversation that will lead to the solutions. If you have any further questions regarding the webinars, you can contact Jess Graham, j.graham@tni.org, who is helping with organizing this. And if you want to watch the previous webinar, which was on building an internationalist response in general, you can find it on tni.org, www.tni.org. That's where you find all the material. Please, if you have a moment, support our work. If you have resources that you can give, please support our work. We welcome donations. This is not free. We need to research. We need to work and bring all of this together. To stay in touch with TNI, please sign up to our newsletter, tni.org/subscribe. And if you have any topics for webinars that you think you would like to see happen, put together by TNI, please also do get in touch and we'll consider. Thank you.